Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest today will be Parvati Marcus. She is the author of a new book called Love Everyone, and she is a developmental editor and writer, and her new book is telling stories of the spiritual teacher Nim Karoli Baba and people's experience, or Westerners that spent time with him in India, and telling stories about their experience. So I'm really excited to have her on, and you will see there is a connection to food there as well. And then I want to just talk about some of the things going on in the news and, of course, share some events that are going on in and around the city that have to do with food. So let's start by talking about this new dietary guidelines that just came out. You know, every 5 years or so, the American USDA comes out with dietary guidelines that are supposed to give guidelines to Americans as to what they should eat. And, you know, very often it's useful, but every 5 years the story changes a bit. This year, I'm very happy to say that the story that they're trying to encourage people to take on is eating a more plant-based diet. However, that actual recommendation, which was recommended not only for everybody's health but also for the health of the planet, was removed from the final document. And why was it removed? You guessed it, lobbyists. There are so many corporate lobbyists out there that are being paid by the American Dairy Association and all of the different meat industries that have an interest in having people eat animal products. They spent millions of dollars on lobbyists to remove that part of the document. So we need to all, once again, do our own research, do our own education, and figure out what we're supposed to eat. It is recommended that we increase our fruits and vegetables, which we've been hearing a lot of. We want to eat whole grains, which we've also been hearing a lot of. But another really big part of this recommendation is they recommended, especially I guess they highlighted men, young men and older men, to really cut down on their protein intake. It seems that American men seem to gravitate towards a lot of protein, and we've always been told that we need so much more protein than we really need, and that's been something that people in the health industry have known about for a while. But too much protein is really taxing to your body. It's not good for your kidneys, that has to process it. It overworks your organs, and it's really not a good thing to eat too much meat. And on the reverse, when you eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, believe it or not, there is protein in vegetables as well, and your body has to work so much harder to extract the protein from those vegetables. Think of it as exercising your organs. Rudolf Steiner talked about that eating plant-based food is healthier for you because it exercises your organs to help you extract all of that protein from the vegetables, not to mention all the other vitamins and minerals that are in the vegetables. So for everyone, increase your fruit and vegetable intakes, whole grains, cut back on the protein, and drastically cut back on animal proteins. And you will be good. You know, I think you also need to read between the lines. If you are not living in a bubble, you know that we've been doing lots of talk about genetically modified foods. Those are foods you want to avoid as well. They are where the DNA of the plant is spliced with the DNA of something else that doesn't belong in the plant to make it more resistant to pests and diseases. And that has really backfired and has caused a lot of health problems for the general public, and is really not yielded us any greater yields or improved the conditions or the quality of the fruits and vegetables at all. It's actually done the reverse. So try to stay away from genetically modified foods. Some doctors are even prescribing genetically modified food diets or GMO-free diets as a way to get rid of anti-inflammatory conditions in the body. And inflammatory conditions in the body seems to be the root of so many diseases. And right now, half of the American population has some sort of food-related chronic disease that can be attributed to food. And we're talking about like 17 million people. So, you know, disease that is caused by our poor diets is just running rampant, and we really need to pull back the reins and get that under control. So that's, you know, one main thing I want to talk to everyone about. So read up on that. On my website, I actually have a link to the PDF file of that document if you actually want to see the guidelines, or just, you know, Google it. There's so many articles on the new dietary guidelines, which are good for all of us to know about. Lots of great things going on in and around the city. January 16th, out here on Long Island in Woodbury at the Absolute Yoga Studio, is an event called Divine Dining. And this is transforming your eating habits using ancient techniques to learn how to approach mealtime in a mindful way. That's being presented by Living Lotus Group, and that's from 2 to 4 on January 16th. Restaurant Week is coming up, January 18th through February 5th. That's, you know, many hundreds of New York City restaurants. It's an opportunity to try restaurants that otherwise might be outside of your reach. I can't help but mentioning the review on the restaurant Per Se that was in New York. Per Se is one of those restaurants that is out of many people's reach because a basic tasting menu is $350 a person. Average meal ticket, I think, for four people is like $3,000, this article said. But anyway, they just went from a four-star restaurant down to a two-star restaurant from Pete Wells' review in the New York Times yesterday. So that's pretty interesting. If you're interested in that kind of thing, check out that article. It reminded me of the movie Chef when they reviewed his restaurant so poorly. I could just see Thomas Keller responding similarly. Coming up, January 22nd to the 24th, 2016, NOFA New York is their winter conference. That happens every year up in Saratoga Springs. NOFA New York is our nonprofit representation to organic agriculture in this area, and it brings lots of farmers together, food producers, environmentalists, for lots of workshops and seminars, and of course there's always the big contra dance and music. So it's a great time. You can go on the NOFA New York website to see the schedule. You don't have to go for the whole weekend. You can really just go for a day. If there's a particular workshop or seminar you want to participate in, you can just head up for that. So check out the schedule. It's really a great time. January 23rd is the Winter Bourbon Festival out on Long Island at TJ Finley's. They'll be sampling over 30 whiskeys and 30 craft beers from their bar, as well as giving out some food, so that should be fun. January 23rd to the 27th is the National Farmers Union 2016 Women's Conference. That's taking place in New Orleans. Should be a great opportunity if you are a woman getting back into agriculture. You know, it's wonderful to meet other women. And believe it or not, the polls show that most new young farmers are women. So go women. Let's bring some good food back to the table. January 26th, the Manhattan Slur is happening, and that's Slow Food New York City's monthly happy hour. This month it will be happening at West Sales in Manhattan from 7 to 9. You can go to the Slow Food New York City website, or again, you can go to my website for any of these. I list all these events on my website. February 8th through 9th is the Soil and Nutrition Conference taking place up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. This is being organized by the Bionutrient Food Association, and I did a workshop with them up at Stone Barns, and it was really great, very informative. It's so important for us to all know about how we can replenish the soil in an organic way and get our soil rich so that our fruits and vegetables have more nutritious value than otherwise. It's really important to realize that all broccolis are not created equal. Depending on the soil that broccoli is grown in will depend on its nutrients, and it makes sense. Just like, you know, a healthy baby comes from a mom who's eaten well. Healthy vegetables come from soil that is fed well. So the synthetic fertilizers and the you know, the synthetic traditional farming that's happening right now, or not traditional, but that's what they're calling it, farming, the non-organic farming, is really producing vegetables that are really substandard. So we really want to up the quality of our fruits and vegetables, and we can do that learning about good soil nutrition. So check that out. The Long Island Regional Seeds Consortium is having their seed swap on February 13th. That's on Long Island. But every area usually has some sort of seed swap. So check your local, you know, farming association and see if you are having a seed swap. It's always best if you can get seeds that are grown in your local area and swap with other farmers. You'll know what their experiences were with it. You can learn and share great secrets and ways of working that will help you grow the healthiest vegetables you can. So that's a wonderful thing to do. So February 13th is a seed swap on Long Island. Last I checked, they still weren't sure where it was going to be taking place. So they just said, save the date. I will let you know as soon as I find out. February 16th to 18th is a local seafood summit. That's not so local to here. It's down in Norfolk, Virginia. But the reason I'm sharing that is because fish has been in the news so much. We really want to support local fisheries that are fishing in the correct way, not disrupting the floor of the oceans. And we also want to support fishermen so that they can make a sustainable living as well. So there's two different events happening about around seafood. This is one from February 16th to 18th in Norfolk, Virginia. And then there's another one being sponsored by Slow Fish, or, you know, Slow Food. This is Slow Fish New Orleans is doing one March 10th through the 13th. So both of those, again, are on my website, so check that out. Save the date for the Just Food Conference coming up March 13th. Just Food is a great nonprofit in the city that's bringing lots of farmers markets to food desert areas and really supporting urban gardening and urban farms and doing a great training program for young farmers who want to learn. So it's a great organization. This is a great event for them. It's a fundraiser, but it's also just a really great educational opportunity for everybody. It brings together over 700 organizers and community leaders for this conference. It's taking place at the Teachers College at Columbia University. Again, that's March 13th. Save the date. $65 for everyone, students, $40. And they always have a great networking opportunity also if you're looking for internships. So I recommend that. April 8th through 9th is the Food and Enterprise Summit, and that's an opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors to work together to create a better local food system. Keep your eyes open for that. April 8th to 9th, save the date. And there's lots more, but I'm not going to go into it right now for time's sake, but do check my website at ieatgreen.com. You can also sign up for my weekly newsletter if you want to know ahead of time who my guests are going to be. But before I invite Parvati Marcus on, my guest this week, I'm going to share this recipe with you. This is a lentil miso soup, and this time of year as the weather gets colder, I very often look for hearty winter soups to keep me warm, and this one did the trick last week. So it's a lentil miso soup, and you don't very often think of lentils and miso together, but this really worked very, very well. So I started in a large pot. Well, actually, let me give you the ingredients first. You're going to need some olive oil, 2 onions chopped, 2 carrots chopped, 3 celery stalks chopped. And you don't want to chop them too fine because, you know, you want some chunks in your soup. 2 tablespoons of chopped garlic, 1 cup. I used French lentils because that's what I had, but if you have only regular lentils, you can use that. And if you have red lentils, that would work too. 2 cups of shredded cabbage. It could be red or white, whichever you have. 2 cups of boiling water. I'm sorry, 12 cups of boiling water. 2 bay leaves, 2 teaspoons of thyme, 2 tablespoons of chopped dill, 1 quarter cup chopped parsley, 6 tablespoons red miso, 1.5 teaspoons salt, and 3/4 teaspoon pepper. So in a large pot, I sauteed the onions and carrots in the olive oil first for about 5 minutes. Then I added the celery, the cabbage, and the garlic and sauteed that for about 5 more minutes. Then I added the lentils and brought that to a boil with the boiling water. Then I added the bay leaves and the herbs. Bring it back up to a boil and let it simmer. Lower the heat now and let it simmer for about 40 minutes until the lentils are soft. I removed a cup of the broth, just, you know, used a ladle and got the broth out of it, one cup, and mixed it in a bowl, small bowl, with the miso. Then I added the dissolved miso back into the larger pot. The main thing you want to know is once you've added miso, miso has so many, it's fermented and has so many medicinal qualities to it. You don't want to let it boil once you've added the miso, because that reduces the medicinal value of the miso. So just let it simmer once you add the miso back. Taste it, adjust the salt and pepper. You can also serve it with a sprinkle of hot pepper. When you go to a Japanese restaurant and they serve broth, they usually serve a little shake of hot red pepper. So that's what I served with it. And it was just great, really warming and delicious on a cold, wintry day. If you're in Florida, as my guest is, you might not need it for warming you up from the cold, but it's still delicious, even on a warmer day. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Parvati Marcus. As I said, she's the author of the new book, Love Everyone, and she's a developmental editor and writer of spiritually-oriented nonfiction books and memoirs. And she's done a lot of work with many people, members of our local satsang, which means spiritual community, from Ram Dass's classic Be Here Now book, which she helped before she went to India. And then when she went to India in 1971-72, after that she helped Dada Mukherjee's book, By His Grace and the Near and Dear. More recently, she's helped Krishna Das in his book, Chance of a Lifetime. She's also the former president of the board of Nim Karoli Baba Ashram and Temple in Taos, New Mexico, and also a former developmental consultant for the Global Peace Initiative of Women's Religious and Spiritual Leaders, held at the United Nations in Geneva, Switzerland. She currently lives in West Palm Beach. Parvati, are you with me?
I'm with you. Hi there, Bhavani.
Hi, Parvati. Welcome. So glad to have
you
on.
What a lot of nice, good information you give everybody. That's fantastic.
I do. It's my passion. And, I should share with everyone that we go way back, back when I first was introduced to the teachings of Nim Karoli Baba through Ram Dass. And I was just so happy to see when this book came out, I just knew I wanted you to have you come on to share with everyone some of these wonderful Maharaji, is Nim Karoli Baba is called, his stories with everybody. So I thought we could start first. Maybe you could share with us a little bit of your story, what your life was like before you encountered Eastern philosophy and what drew you into seeking Eastern philosophy.
Well, let's see. I grew up in a very, very non-religious setting. I mean, my parents were Jewish, and the emphasis on the ish, because basically I thought that meant bagels and lox and, the New York Times on Sunday. That was pretty much what it was. Uh-huh. And it wasn't until, and you got to remember, folks, we're talking about the 60s, it wasn't until I took acid and came down from my first trip, which was a real experience of total immersion into the oneness of everything, and somebody handed me the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that I suddenly realized that there was this vast wealth of Eastern information that seemed so relevant to my life that I had never heard of. And 3 weeks after that experience, I met Ram Dass.
Uh-huh.
So my life did, a complete flip. I went from just being a basic hippie at the time to being a spiritual seeker. And a year and a half later, I was in India.
Uh-huh. And your first trip to India was in 1970?
71, yeah.
71.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd say my experience was relatively similar. I was brought up on Long Island in a Jewish family that also Judaism was more about family and bringing people together and celebrating holidays than really the religious aspect of it. But I felt, I guess I felt early on that I was looking for something, and I never found it in Judaism. When I'd go to temple or whatever, I never felt any oneness there. And so I know
I never even got
something.
To temple, so so it wasn't even a question.
Now, in your book, you call about the call. What called you to India, and what do you mean about the call?
Well, what I mean about the call is this urge inside that won't go away. You know, so that you're being called to do something that's related to your passion, or it's your soul calling to you and saying, you know, this is what's next, listen. And for me, that call came through Ram Dass. I mean, when I first met Ram Dass, I had met a guy at a party who said, hey, you want to go meet a saint? And 3 weeks before, I would have said no. But after having taken acid, I said, sure, why not? Mm-hmm. And as we drove up to his place, you know, he's standing outside, and I could see light coming from him, and it completely blew me away. And I thought, you know, after spending that summer with him, I wanted to go to where he had gone and get what he had gotten from the source he had gotten it from. So that
right.
became my call.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so many others. I mean, it's almost like a pilgrimage. When you read your book, you mm-hmm. realize there was like busloads of seekers, you know, all hippies.
It was
know,
that
suddenly...
time, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, those who had a lot of the opening, of course, came through psychedelics. But it came through other ways for other people, you know, sometimes even just the music or the Beatles going to India and meeting a guru or, you know, whatever it was, that suddenly became a real pull. And there were many seekers who found their way on the journey to the East.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I'm not going to go into it a lot because I've not really read up on it recently, but I know they're actually even bringing acid back into study now
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I think Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, when they first started playing with acid, you know, in the psychology department at Harvard, they were doing it, you know, as a way to experiment with the mind in a, you
mm-hmm.
know, in somewhat of a medicinal way. And then when it got this bad rap, people abandoned it. And yet they're now bringing it back because I think they're realizing there is a connection to how people can view life in
Absolutely.
A more, mm-hmm. in a more seamless way, you know, as opposed
mm-hmm.
to this plane and then another plane, you know, the heavens and the, you know.
Right.
You see the oneness. And like you mentioned that when you first experienced acid, it does meld the line between the, you know, the formless and the form and the spiritual and the unspiritual. I mean, everything becomes one.
Mm.
And, you know, yes, you're right. using an artificial means to experience that, but then it kind of shows you that it's just changing your viewpoint, that already exists like that.
Right, which is a wonderful thing, that it can change your perspective. You don't need to keep taking it. It's
right.
like, I don't want to make people think they have to go out and take acid now. They don't. Because
right.
back then, I mean, we were breaking out of, you know, the madman consciousness of the 50s and early 60s.
Right.
And, you know, there were no yoga studios. There were no meditation teachers. There were no spiritual books around, or very few spiritual books around. You know, so a lot of what I wanted to show in this book was how we went, you know, seeking something in the East. We found something and brought it back. And a lot
right.
of the people who went became, you know, the teachers of meditation or the teachers of this, or found a way to bring that consciousness back into whatever Western field that they were involved in.
Yeah, and that's so true. And later on in our conversation, I do want to touch on some of the biographies I know you have at the back of the book, which was
mm-hmm.
so delightful to read, you know, all the different contributions that all the people that had been with Nim Karoli Baba, what they did bring back, and how, you know, his teachings have been shared here in this country and other countries from
mm-hmm.
the people that he touched. It's just You know, it's amazing when you see how that works.
Exactly.
It's amazing. So what was your first impression when you met Maharaji?
Oh, wow. Well, it was interesting because I had, you know, once I had gotten hooked onto the spiritual path, you know, before I got to India, and, you know, various gurus were starting to come to the West, like Swami Muktananda, and, you know, I was studying with Hilda Charlton, and all these people were coming through. And everyone I met, and when I went to India, I first went and saw Sai Baba, and I always felt like something had to be wrong with me. My heart just wasn't opening. You know, it was like I didn't feel comfortable bowing in front of any of them. I didn't feel comfortable, you know, being a devotee of any of the ones I met. When I first met Maharaji, it was like instantaneous. It's the surrender that is no surrender. It was, I was home. And that's what you read over and over again in everybody's story, is that moment of going, I'm home. I'm finally home. You know, it's like the place you've always belonged, the thing you always wanted to feel, the love you never got anywhere else, it's all there. And the first time I met him, I was sitting with my friend Radha, and it was both our first darshans, darshan just meaning you're being in the presence of Maharaji. And we both started laughing hysterically. I mean, some people cry, some people, and we just laughed. And he turned around on his tucket and put his finger up to his mouth, and he went, shh, you know, like, and we just laughed more and more and more. It was extraordinary. And he let me know that he had been with me all those years before I got to India.
Uh-huh. And how did he let you know that?
Well, it was interesting. After that summer I had spent with Ram Dass, which was the summer of 69, when you know, Woodstock was sort of happening down the street from where we were.
Uh-huh.
After that summer, I had gone to a friend's place, and we had split a tab of acid, and it had all split on my side. And I went into this huge initiatory experience. And the next day I was still sort of tripping, but in much lower realms. And I was getting scared. And Ram Dass was off at Lama Foundation, and there was no way to reach him. And I hadn't yet met Hilda, who became my first real teacher. And I had nobody to call and say, what do I do? So I sat with this little picture of Maharaji that he had given me, that Ram Dass had given me, this little black and white picture. And I kept saying, I'm scared and you've got to help me. It was like my mantra, I'm scared and you've got to help me. And the photo dissolved in blue light, and I saw Maharaji there. And I was able to, it was just for a second, but I was able to lie down and go through whatever I had to go through, and everything was okay. And after that, I got a much larger picture, needless to say. And I used to talk to it all the time. I mean, I sort of led my life in front of this picture of Maharaji. And I didn't tell anybody this, because back then you didn't tell people you talked to pictures.
Right. Right, they'd have you, you know,
yeah, right,
sent away.
So anyway, in the first darshan with Maharaji, at one point he leaned over and he looked at me and he said, you used to talk to my picture all the time. You asked many questions. So, you know, he was acknowledging, you know, that he had been there. All those times I thought I saw him in a picture, he was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's,
well,
it's
went
sort
to
of
India
interesting
for
people
time.
Who weren't with him, because obviously space and time are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, I went to India 2 years ago for my first time and went to his ashram and met some of his older devotees, thinking of KK, you know, and just hearing some of the stories was so fascinating, how he was everywhere at the same time, so many times,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, how's that possible? But you'd hear these stories, and I mean, over and over again, and that's what's so lovely about your book, is that it's, you know, everybody's stories, and you know, I love stories, you know, I feel like I know Maharaji through the stories that I share, that everybody shared with me, you know, 30 years ago when I first was meeting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, having them all compiled in this book is just so wonderful. I really thank you so much for putting this all together.
No, but it was totally my pleasure. I mean, I got to go around and interview over 70 people and sit there and talk for hours about Maharaji. What could be better?
Right, right. Well, Maharaji is also known for feeding people, and I promised everybody I'd get to the food part.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that was one of my, I wouldn't say I knew that that was one of my connections, but you would always hear about Maharaji and food stories, and that he, you know, always said that you have to feed everybody, and you can't talk to anybody about God if they're hungry. They first have to be satiated. You have to feed them on a physical level before you can feed them on a spiritual level. And I loved hearing that. He was always about feeding people. So can you shed a little light on what was his thing about feeding people? How did that come across so strongly to me?
Well, it's very, you know, he didn't teach, he didn't lecture, he didn't have a program we needed to do, you know, anything like that. He had very, very basic teachings. And the most basic one was love everyone, feed everyone, and remember God. And that's what we heard over and over again. And by feed everyone, I mean, first of all, he meant make sure that they're not hungry. I mean, his ashrams were built in very poor places in India. And often the prasad, which is sort of the food that has been offered, you know, was frequently the only meal that the local population might have that day. So he was very, very insistent about everybody who came to the ashrams had to be fed food, but he also meant it in the broader sense of serve everyone. In other words, that, you know, find the way in which you can feed people, whether that's through your words, your actions, you know, or what you do on top of the stove, you know.
Right.
So he would. A lot of things did center around food. I mean, we were fed enormous quantities of fried spicy potatoes and deep-fried puris, which are a flatbread that's fried. And you could sit down and eat like a mound of potatoes and a stack of puris and not feel like you had eaten at all, because I think he used it to ground us, you know, for being around such intense energy. But boy, did we eat a lot.
Yeah, well, I remember that, you know, even here in New York, after, you know, we'd have a spiritual evening of, you know, meditation, singing, whatever, people would have to eat before, people have to eat after, you know, really to ground you. Otherwise, you could just feel like you could just go into a cave and never come out.
Right. So we were fed. We were fed a lot. Yeah, that and chai.
Right, and you know, I think when you think of most religions, well, actually, I guess I can't talk about most religions. I can talk about the Jewish religion a lot because that's what I was brought up in. And again, I wasn't religious, but for me, I thought, you know, the Jewish holidays all were about eating.
Right. Well, as I said, I thought Jewish,
except for one where you
fasted.
What's that?
It meant bagels and lox.
Right. Well, we went beyond bagels and lox, you know, in just, you know, Passover. Like, most of the Jewish holidays are celebrated at home with
around
family.
Food. Yeah.
Around food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I saw early on for me personally the power of food and bringing people together.
Yeah.
And that's been my calling. I'd say, you know, so much of my life is not just the food part, but what food does when it brings people together. You know, you feed their stomachs, but at the same time, you're opening their hearts.
Right.
And
it's
magical. It's magical.
And that's why it's
food.
One of his main teachings, is feed everyone.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's the way to open a heart.
Yeah.
It's like that old saying, you know, where man's heart is through his stomach.
Right. He was also known for throwing fruit at people. What was that about?
Well, I mean, frequently fruit was brought to Maharaji, you know, to be offered, and it became prasad. And he would take the whatever fruit was brought, you know, whether it was a batch of apples or oranges or bananas, whatever, and throw them out to people, you know. So, there'd be a group of us sitting in front of him, and he would throw fruit. Sometimes somebody would try to be sitting there meditating, which usually you didn't do in front of him because it was just too enticing to watch him.
Right.
Too much fun. And if he tried to meditate, he might take a banana and throw it at you to wake you up.
Right.
To bring you back. It's like, well, you don't have to go anywhere right now. Just stay here. Boom.
Right. Perfect.
And there was a lot of, things happened around that. I mean, suddenly he wouldn't be throwing you fruit. You know, someday he'd be throwing it to everybody else and not to you, and you would go into unworthiness and like, what's wrong with me and what have I done? And, he finally sees I'm not pure enough or whatever it is. So he would play with it. I mean, one of the stories I remember in the book is this guy, Krishna Dobra, and he's going like, give me some prasad, look at me, give me some inkling that I belong here, and there's nothing. And then at one point, when he's at the peak of feeling completely worthless, Maharaji looks at him and takes up a banana and hands it towards him. And as he reaches for it, Maharaji pulls it away and hands it to the person behind him. And he suddenly got it. He got that he was still okay. He didn't need a banana. And, of course, as soon as he got it, after that, every day there were piles of prasad, handed to him.
Right. I think teachers often know, they have a way of just knowing, and they play with you like that. I mean, we had a teacher in New York for many years, Joya, and she would do the same kind of thing, play with you. And, and they just, have a way of triggering that. And I want to actually get into some of the stories. I know there's so many stories in here, and I want you to share with us some of your favorites. But let's take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, you can share with us some of your stories and maybe some food stories, too.
Okay. Very good.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be right back.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman, the host of What Women Must Know. As a naturopathic doctor, psychotherapist, author, and women's health advocate, I've discovered that there is a lot that women must know when it comes to their health and hormones. So whatever your hormonal or health challenge may be, the answers are waiting for you at What Women Must Know. Where leading authors and holistic practitioners, researchers, and wise elders will give you the keys to getting your hormones back on track naturally. Be sure to listen every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM. And if you didn't catch it live, you can listen 24/7 on the archive. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Bobby Elias.
And it's Dr. Sarah Larson.
Hosts of Let's Create a Better World. Our show is for your body, mind, and soul. To have the latest, greatest cultural, creative information available.
Join us with our expert guests every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific.
You can also hear our show on the phone at 619-550-0869.
And don't forget about the archives.
We're moving forward on PRN.FM.
And we want you to come with us.
Saturdays, don't forget. Every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific. Let's create a better world.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Parvati Marcus, the author of the new book, Love Everyone. And we're talking about stories from the book. Hi, Parvati.
Hi.
So can you share with us some of your or a few favorite stories from the book?
Sure. Yeah, let's keep them centered around food.
Yes, let's.
Well, there's one I can think of in particular that's from somebody named Bajanath Das, who is a lawyer in L.A. And this is his story. We go back and forth almost daily to see Maharaji. We would walk there wearing white, carrying flowers, blissful. I was still not comfortable eating Indian food because I wasn't familiar with it. So I ended up going to Maharaji's ashram but not eating his food. Maharaji called me over and said, "You don't eat my food. Why aren't you eating my food?" "Maharaji, I'm not hungry." "I know why you're not eating my food. Last night you had a Coke and cookies for dinner." I thought, "Gee, is he following me around? Is somebody watching me? What's going on? Maybe he thought Americans have Coke and cookies for dinner." Then I realized he was revealing himself to me in a very gentle way. At that moment, and to this day, I felt he knew me and loved me, and I loved him and still do. And, I mean, he used food in so many ways. He also used it, you know, sometimes to, he loved to shake up people, to shake them out of, you know, where they were stuck. And the Indians, you know, in their caste system, he loved to do things that would shake up the Indians. That was, there was somebody named Balaram Das, who became an anesthesiologist later in life. And I'm going to read a story that happened with him. It says, "I'd go to the temple and watch the way that the Indians would express their devotion. I saw that some would take an apple, peel it, slice it, and put it on a leaf plate. I saw them do that several times, and I thought, I could do that. So I got an apple. I had my Swiss Army knife and my leaf plate. I peeled and sliced the apple. Maharaji was sitting there talking with a few gentlemen, and he looked at me holding the plate of apple slices toward him. When I would do something like this, he would get this look of amazement. It was as if your dog sat up and talked to you, and you'd say, 'My God, he talks. Look at what he can do. He's so cute.' Maharaji looked at me with this beautiful look, so much love you can't even describe it. He picked up an apple slice and started chewing on it. Then he grabbed a handful of apple slices and gave them to the Indian men. 'Will you eat this food that he brought?' This is a tricky thing in Indian culture. I had prepared this food. I was probably not qualified to cook food generally for these gentlemen, but on the other hand, it was coming straight from Maharaji's hand, and he had eaten it. They said, 'Oh, yes, Baba, we'll take it.' Maharaji took the rest of the apples, gave them back to me, and said, 'With these apples, I am going to give you great wealth.' 'Great. Go now, come again.' That was one of the first things I learned in Hindi. Maharaji got up and went inside, and these Indians came running over to me and said, 'Oh, my God, that was the greatest thing ever. Do you know what just happened?' I said, 'Well, yeah, he gave me the apples.' They were very excited. It was a great boon, and, of course, it has been." So wow. You can see that he shook up the Indians by handing them this apple that had been sliced by an American.
Right. Right. Well, how did it work also with, as a woman? You know, there's so many different issues around men and women. I know when I went to India, you know, mm-hmm. there's a question, you know, women weren't supposed to stay at the ashram, you know, because they were women. And, you know, and even, there was even questions like who could eat there. And so how did they make those decisions? I mean, I guess it was different,
well,
of course, when Maharaji was alive.
Are you talking about the ashram at Kenchi?
Yes.
Wow, really? No, with Maharaji, there was absolutely no division between the men and the women. I mean, other Indian gurus would have women sitting on one side, men sitting on the other. You know, we had absolutely no restrictions on us.
And were there restrictions with the Indian people?
Yes.
Or just with the Americans, there was no restriction?
No restrictions. And no, not even with the Indian. I mean, men and women sat together. I mean, uh-huh. we were all fed. We were all... you know, there was really no division. Mm-hmm. So that's a little strange to me. I mean, I'm just thinking of one moment when he had me shake up the Indian women, though, which was he was usually sitting on his tucket, which is like this little wooden platform bed, uh-huh. and we would come and, you know, sit around him. One day we walked into the ashram, and he was sitting on the ground,
And, you know, instead of looking like this sort of vast Shiva, you know, from the mountains, as he usually looked to me, suddenly he looked very small and like a child. And I went over and kissed the top of his head. And there were Indian women sitting around him, and they all gasped as if I had done something that was outside the bounds of what you were supposed to do. And he loved it. So the next time he had a group of Indian women sitting around him, he called me over and he pointed to the top of his head, like, come do it again.
Nice. Now, the feeling of being with Maharaji, it seems, you know, the people that I know that were with him, you know, it's not like it just happened and it was a period in their life and then they went on with their life as before. Once you had encountered and been with Nim Karoli Baba, your life was forever changed.
Absolutely.
Can you share with us some of how that has lasted with you and the community or satsang that has come back to the West, how everyone's been affected?
Well, one of the absolutely extraordinary parts of being with Maharaji was experiencing, for the first time in any of our lives, absolute unconditional love. And it's hard to even understand what that experience is, because everything we've usually experienced in our lives has been conditional love, you know, in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So to have this experience and to know that, as he said, he is always with us. It's, I think Dada was the one who said, once he's taken your hand, he never lets go.
Mm-hmm.
And so that experience of being with him, that place that we were in when we were with him, you know, which was like sitting in this state of love, just having had that experience and knowing the reality of that is enough to carry you through the rest of your life. It's sort of like you have, well, I always think of it as being wrapped in a blanket.
Uh-huh.
And it's when I interviewed people, and we're talking, you know, 45 years after Maharaji left his body, and I'm talking
right.
to people. So they've been through a lot of life at that point.
Right.
And
right.
yet that time with Maharaji was still, for most people, the most vivid part of their lives.
Right.
Most easily recalled, most profound, and most important.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing, and I have to, I mean, I want to share this too, for me, even though I was not with Maharaji, the time that I was with my satsang and met the people that had been with Maharaji and took that on as my community, that was the most profound time in my life and has affected my whole life. You know,
exactly.
Even though I might have only lived in a group home for 9 months in that time
mm-hmm.
with, you know, other people that, on the same path, that 9 months touched every single aspect of my life, from, you know, the blind date I was set up on 30 years ago to marry my husband, to the house I'm living in now came through someone, through everything that
everything.
Is important to me
mm-hmm.
in my life.
That's right. And it's not necessary to have met him in the body. That's, you know, people,
right.
I mean, I did the book hoping not that people would get jealous of an experience that a handful of people had, but an understanding that this is a being who's so far beyond time and space that he has touched so many people through hearing other people's stories or through dreams or meditations
yeah.
or, you know, he's come to people in so many ways that being in the body has not been necessary.
Right.
I mean, your
right.
experience is as valid as any of us who were with him.
Yep. Yep. And I, you know, like I said, it affected me like it has affected, you know, everybody else. It,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't feel any different. I actually, people used to joke with me, you know, we used to play cards a lot when I was younger. And I would play cards in, you know, the position Maharaji would always be in, where he's like on his side, propped up on his elbow
right.
and his shoulder with his one foot crossed over the other, you know, sitting sideways,
uh-huh.
like in this funny contorted looking position. That's how I played cards.
I lived in that position. People, when they saw the picture of Maharaji in that position, it was like, oh, my God, someone else is in the same position as you. And I mean, it was the most comfortable position for me to be in, to play cards. And people would always make fun of me. And it was, you know, it was one of those moments it was like, I know where I got that from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what else I want to ask you? How did you reconcile what you learned in the East with now coming back and living in the West? How did you integrate that into, you know, because I would think for so many people, one, when you're in India, you don't really so much have to worry about making a living. But once you've had that experience and then you come back and you have to mitigate our life here and the world here and people's expectations and judgments and all that stuff, how... You know, let's talk, you know, for you personally, not even just everybody else, but how did you weave that into making a life
here? Oh, it
was
hard. It was really hard coming back. People ask me about, you know, was there culture shock going to India? And in truth, there really wasn't. I was very, very much at home in India.
Uh-huh.
And certainly, you know, once I was with Maharaji, I was truly home. And coming back to the West was shocking. I mean, it started with our trip back from India when we landed in London and was standing on a street corner of London at a time when hot pants were the fashion, these, like, lime-colored satin short shorts.
Uh-huh.
And we stood there with our mouths hanging open because we hadn't seen above a woman's ankle in over a year.
You
know, so that was funny. But when we actually came back and had to start living in the West, and at first we held on very, very tightly to everything we thought was, like, you know, holy and the way to do things. I mean, I remember my new mother-in-law giving me a pair of beautiful leather gloves, and I was horrified. Leather, you know?
Right.
Something I couldn't imagine. But eventually we realized that what we had to do was integrate. I mean, we couldn't leave behind what we had learned in the East. It was too real. It was too much a part of who we became and who we were. And so what we did is people found their ways back into what it was they either had been doing before or in a new direction, and found a way in which they were comfortable in serving, because as long as they felt they were serving in some way, then it was okay.
Right.
You know, nobody went off and became an arms dealer.
Right.
You know, or people, you know, I did it mostly through writing. I mean, I tried to work only on projects that I felt would promote something valuable, you know, that people could read a book and get something real from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my path. You know, other people did it in many other ways, from those who wound up in, you know, healthcare services to those who, you know, became meditation teachers or founded centers like Mirabai Bush did. You know, I mean, just or people who did movies. Or look at Krishnadas. Krishnadas is now in India bringing kirtan back to the Indians.
Isn't that amazing?
I know. Which is just extraordinary.
I know. And, you know, he says it in his movie. I mean, he struggled for so long to try to find a way that he could be real and earn a living at the same time.
Right.
And who would have ever thought that he'd be able to make, not just make a living, but become famous in a sense through his kirtan?
And
your ex-husband, you know, started off, you know, doing a rock and roll station in Montreal, and, you know, it's changed, but he's still doing recordings. And
he went into doing world music, you know, and now he runs the Luxor Remember Foundation.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and those foundations, you know, you mentioned Mirabai, you know, the Seva Foundation or the Lama Foundation, you know. Actually, Mirabai, talking about old connections, when I first got pregnant with my daughter and I was on welfare and I was living up in Boston, you know, trying to keep my head above water, they helped me out. I used to staple their illumination stickers
onto the cardboard. You know, they made the company Illuminations that made the rainbow stickers, you know, for the cars. I know you know this. I'm saying this for the audience.
You know, they became written up. That company was written up in Forbes and various financial magazines and all sorts of places because it was a company that became very successful and was run on principles of mindfulness inclusiveness and not on standard business practices, you know.
When you talk about mindfulness, it was a meditation for me. I would staple those things. I had a little jig that I made up, and I just put that cardboard in. I was like singing the whole time. Well, I go stamp, like for hours while my kid was sleeping. I would be stapling these illuminations, and I got, I don't know, 3 cents of cardboard thing or something. But, I mean, that's how far back these connections go, you know.
Right.
Like I was saying, through my whole life. But we're just about out of time, so before we finish, can you share with everyone, tell everyone where they can find your book? I know Amazon,
Amazon, of course. They can also go to ramdas.org, and there's a way to get it through there, and also to see, like, a little video that was put together, clips of people speaking their stories.
On the ramdas.org website?
On the ramdas.org site.
Ah, perfect. I'll share that.
You know, and there's more stories there as well. So, you know, also Barnes & Noble, any place you can buy books, basically. It's available. Or if you go to your bookstore and they're not carrying it, tell them to bring them in.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Parvi, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing the stories. Thank you for putting them in such a beautiful book for so many people to see. And everyone out there for listening, thank you for joining us. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now. Thank you, Parvati. Bye.